Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. Now that Israel has a new right-wing government in place, does the Biden administration have a new strategy to deal with it? Let's get to the bottom line. The Middle East has long been put on the back burner by U.S. administrations, but there's been a flurry of diplomatic activity after Israel held its latest elections. President Joe Biden sent his national security adviser, Jake Sullivan, to meet with Israeli and Palestinian leaders last week. And now his Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is going next week. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has stacked his new government with ministers who, let's face it, have a history of racism and incitement against Palestinians and is moving towards basically annexing the West Bank. That goes against official U.S. policy, which is to keep the door open to a Palestinian state. But is that still on the table? Or is U.S. policy toward Israel mainly focused on other regional issues like Iran and Saudi Arabia? Today, we're talking with Professor Juan Cole, who teaches history at the University of Michigan and is the chief editor of Informed Comment, a website focused on U.S. foreign policy. Dr. Cole, it's so good to be talking with you again. Can you give our viewers a snapshot of the moment, both politically in Israel, politically in Palestine, and what Joe Biden is up to sending his national security advisor and secretary of state into Israel now?
The Israeli political system is broken. It's had, the state has had several elections in just a couple of years. And they've been had a great deal of difficulty putting together a ruling coalition that had any staying power. One of the problems had been that most center and center-right parties in Israel were reluctant to align with the Likud party, which is led by Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu is is on trial for corruption and is notoriously difficult to work with. They did put together a government last year that just lasted for a year, but only by the expediency of inviting essentially a Muslim Brotherhood party of Palestinian Israelis to join the government. It was the first time this had happened in Israeli history, and that was a very difficult coalition of 8 parties that didn't agree with one another, and it collapsed last summer, in part over the West Bank, because there's a law that extends Israeli law and administration to the squatters from Israel on Palestinian land in the West Bank. That was up for renewal, and the part of the coalition that was Palestinian Israelis declined to go along with voting it in. And so the government collapsed over that. They had new elections. And since the center-right didn't want to coalesce with Netanyahu, he wanted to put together a government. He was willing to cross red lines that had been there in Israeli politics and to invite into his cabinet members of very, very, very far-right parties. I mean, it would not be wrong to call them racist and fascist parties, leaders of which had, in fact, been convicted of racial incitement in the past. These were untouchable groups in previous Israeli politics, but Netanyahu wanted to be prime minister so much that he brought them in. And he not only brought them in, but gave them a great deal of power, including over the Palestinian occupied population in the Palestinian West Bank. Well, Netanyahu has made pronouncements that he wants to extend Israeli sovereignty everywhere, including the Negev and the West Bank, where there are substantial Palestinian-Israeli populations. And there's talk of annexation of the West Bank or of parts of it. This is a huge public relations problem for the Biden administration.
So I guess my question is, what, from your perspective, is not clicking in terms of Israel coming to terms with its immediate neighborhood, even though it had the Abraham Accords and even though it has normalized with other parts of the Arab world.
Well, Steve, you make good points. It's kind of shocking to see a society like Israel's, which is full of highly educated people, the majority of whom have liberal values, being ruled by this kind of very far-right government. But on the other hand, you know, let's look at it this way. First of all, Israel shouldn't be thought of as that different from other countries. Its GDP is kind of like Portugal's. Although people are well off in Israel, there's still poverty, and the per capita income is, you know, is a middle-income country. So it's not a rich country. It's not Dubai. And moreover, it's an immigrant society. And this is very important for its political evolution. The first generation of politically active Israelis who came after World War II were many of them Holocaust survivors, you know, were European, Central European Jews, and these are called Ashkenazim, and they tended to be left of center. The Labor Party kind of ruled the roost and dominated many institutions in Israeli society. But at the same time that they were coming, or a little later, actually, riots broke out and various forms of persecution broke out in the Muslim world against Jews who were then identified with Israelis. And there was anger over the expulsion of the Palestinians in the formation of Israel in the Arab world. And so large numbers of people came to Israel who were Easterners. They were Sephardim or Mizrahim Jews, and they had very different values and customs and folkways than the Central European Jews did. So you were throwing Tunisians and Moroccans and Iranians in with Germans and Poles and so forth. And initially, the Eastern Jews were disadvantaged. They had the lowest jobs in society. They were menials, and there were demonstrations in 1965 on their part against the Ashkenazi dominance of everything. But then from the 70s, they got to be numerous enough that they were invited in by the Likud party, which is a right-wing party, to challenge labor and to challenge the Israeli center-left. And they went for it with alacrity. And so you have this Middle Eastern Jewish community with Middle Eastern antecedents that hews to the right, feels, you know, aggrieved in the same way, perhaps, that Trump's supporters in the United States felt aggrieved by their exclusion from the heights of Israeli society. And then in the 90s, you had a million post-Soviet people come in, Russians and Ukrainians and other people from the old East Bloc. And they were from a society that was, you know, the Soviet Union and the post-Soviet Union Russia was collapsing. They lost 10 million people and to alcoholism, and their institutions weren't functioning. And these people who came in to Israel wanted to make a new life, and they had no sympathy with, you know, Palestinians. They were in it for themselves.
Right. What are the problems of legitimacy and direction on the Palestinian side?
Well, you know, those elections that were held in 2006 were relatively free and open, and Hamas won them.
Right.
And the Bush administration had convinced the Israeli government over its better instincts to allow Hamas to run. And Hamas's victory was unacceptable to the Americans and to the Israelis. It was a huge mistake on Bush's part. Then they overthrew the Hamas government, arrested many of its members, except they were unable to overthrow it in the Gaza Strip. But in the West Bank, it was simply, there was a coup in favor of the PLO. And since the PLO doesn't know whether it would win another election, it doesn't hold them. And I think the Americans and the Israelis are you know, put pressure on them not to hold them. It's true that the Palestine Authority is riddled with corruption. But, you know, I don't think that the blame for this stagnation of Palestinian politics in the West Bank and Gaza, or for the more extremist voices that we hear from it, you know, falls on the Palestinians. They're an occupied people. They're not allowed very much in the way of autonomy. And even the Palestine Authority, which helps the Israelis to police the Palestinians, basically, only its writ only runs to 40% of the West Bank. The rest is under direct Israeli military rule. So an occupied population that's gradually having its prerogatives taken away, its sovereignty taken away, its land taken away, is not going to throw up healthy politics. This is not a situation that's going to be conducive to that.
You know, one of the things that has struck me over years of being interested in this issue is watching American senior officials come out with a strong objective to try to resolve these issues, you know, deal with, try to figure out strategies to deoccupy the West Bank. I remember Secretary John Kerry, now the climate envoy of President Biden, said there's no more important issue, would always show us maps in his office of things that he felt were outrageous and that he was going to make them the highest priority and go in and do them. And every single time these efforts were neutralized or not taken forward by the presidents in place. What do you think President Biden is trying to do, really, with Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken right now? Or is it just floundering?
Well, I have a pretty cynical view of American policy on this, Steve. I think the Biden administration is among the more pro-Israeli administrations that we've seen. It's not going to play fair with the Palestinians. And I think, you know, the way that the Americans have muddled through their knee-jerk support for virtually anything any Israeli government does is to keep talking about a peace process and a two-state solution. And there hasn't been a peace process of any genuine sort for a decade. And the prospect of the Israelis ever letting the Palestinians have a state is slim to none. So these are just mantras. These are just things that, you know, the U.S. gets criticized by its European allies for supporting this insupportable illegal occupation of 5 million people who are stripped of citizenship and of basic human rights. And what does the U.S. say? Well, we're working on it. We have a peace process. There'll be a two-state solution. So what these envoys from Biden are doing are going to Netanyahu and saying, Bibi, shut up. You know, you are upsetting the apple cart here because the things you are saying are incompatible with our mantras, incompatible with a two-state solution, incompatible with there being a peace process. I don't think the pressure is on him to do very much, but they just don't want him to give away the show and tell the world what exactly is happening.
Well, you know, another dimension here that I find interesting is Netanyahu seems to be indicating that they're very close to announcing, you know, normalization of some sort with Saudi Arabia. Is there a point where relations with Saudi Arabia, with China, with Russia, outflank America's influence with Israel, despite all of our contributions, despite all of American investment in Israel? Is there a point geopolitically where Israel has options other than the United States?
Well, I don't think that's even on the table right now, Steve. The Israelis and the United States are very close, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. I think what the issue with expanding the number of states that recognize Israel in the Arab world is that Jared Kushner picked off the easy ones already. So the United Arab Emirates has never really been at war with Israel and isn't close to it and is a small state of a million citizens plus 9 million or 8 million guest workers. So, and which wanted access to Israeli technology. So they're doing great technological interchanges, the UAE and Israel. It was a marriage made in heaven from their point of view. And Bahrain, it's a tiny country in the Persian Gulf, which is deeply afraid of being annexed by Iran, would do anything to avoid that. And so even making friends with Israel, which is anti-Iranian, makes sense for them. They brought in Morocco, which has its own domestic problems. This was a way of getting international recognition for Morocco's claims to the Western Sahara. But then after that, Algeria, Syria, these other countries are not, you're not going to so easily convince them. And even Saudi Arabia, you know, the old guard in Saudi Arabia, King Salman and the people around him are dead set against normal relations with Israel until there's a Palestinian state. They put forward, the Saudis put forward a peace plan in the early zeros, and they still stick to it. The younger generation in Saudi Arabia of leaders like Mohammed bin Salman, I think, would be perfectly happy, and he's signaled this in New York, to throw the Palestinians under the bus and just make normal relations with Israel. But I think until his father dies, you're a little unlikely to see progress on normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia. And the fact that Netanyahu has brought in these flaming extremists on the Zionist side makes it even more difficult for King Salman to move forward. And remember, there's the Saudis are 40% Wahhabi, and there are a lot of people in Saudi Arabia who are really anti-Israel. And while the king is an absolute monarch, he does have to shift with the winds a little bit. So taking this step at this juncture, I think, could really cause domestic troubles in Saudi Arabia. And for that reason, I don't expect them to do
well, that. I think one of the constant, you know, dimensions of the chessboard in the region is whether, you know, Iran continues to be the driver of closer relationships between these states, you know, the UAE and, as you said, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia and Israel, whether it happens now or, you know, a few years from now. I mean, essentially a common purpose of defense. But along that line, I want to raise a letter. There was an open letter published by someone you know well, former U.S. ambassador to Israel, Daniel Kurtzer, wrote an open letter to President Biden, and here it is. He says, Israel should be told that while the United States will continue to support its allies' legitimate security requirements, it will not provide offensive weapons or other assistance for malign Israel actions in Jerusalem or the occupied territories. Perhaps what Dan Kurtzer is saying, let's not give Israel any tools to further encroach or move on what Prime Minister Netanyahu has said by, you know, finally enveloping and annexing all of the West Bank. But at the same time, there is a very big security dimension to the Abraham Accords, and there's a very big security dimension to our relationship with Israel on its defense that does involve trying to preempt both Iran and its appendages that are operating in the Middle East. So how do you square, how do you read Dan Kurtzer's comment and square it?
Well, I think Kurtzer is a very judicious thinker on these matters, and that the Biden administration has taken to heart what he said. It's been leaked, and, you know, I can't prove this, but it's been leaked that Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, when he met with Netanyahu, even put pressure on him about his domestic plans, that Netanyahu wants to neuter the Israeli court system and to allow Parliament to overrule judicial review of a law that's found unconstitutional with just a simple majority, and to have the prime minister play a bigger role or a role he doesn't now have in appointing justices and so forth. The steps that, if they were taken in the form that they've been suggested, would make Israel, you know, another Hungary. It would be a big move towards autocracy. And it's leaked that Sullivan told him that if he does this to the courts, that it's going to make it very difficult for the Biden administration to get Israel many of the things that Israel wants from the U.S. Congress, because you have a 40-caucus progressive wing of the Biden Democratic Party, a 40-person caucus, that is extremely upset about what's going on in Israel and the lack of progress towards rights for Palestinians. And if Israel starts to look more and more like a third world dictatorship, the liberal Democrats are just not going to give the Israelis the benefit of the doubt in their appropriations votes.
But just finally, you know, when you kind of look at the politics of that, if that 40-member progressive wing of the House, which is no longer in control of the House, or even President Biden were to veto packages of support that came in from Congress, from a Republican-controlled House that got through the Senate and were, you know, turned there, and Biden were to reject that, we have elections in the United States in 2 years. Does this become a very big political issue when we may see the return of President Trump or someone who seems and sounds a lot like President Trump, perhaps Ron DeSantis or others, you know, come along where now we have a very stark divide that is very consequential for the course of Israel, depending on whether a Republican president wins or a Democratic president wins?
Yeah, well, Netanyahu has more or less openly campaigned for Republican presidents. There isn't any doubt that he feels that Israel is given a greater room for maneuver by the Republicans. And it's true that President Trump really didn't deny them anything they wanted. But we don't know, of course, where the future lies. But Biden is not able to act unilaterally. He has his own Democratic Party to please, and he seems to want to run for re-election, which means making Democrats enthusiastic about him. Well, if you look at the polling, there are a lot of Democrats who are very upset with the Netanyahu government and the direction that Israel is going, and especially among the young people. And it appears that the youth vote, which is often called upon but seldom materializes, actually made a very significant difference in the midterms and helped Democrats avoid losing a lot of seats. So Biden is in a tough position because he has to make his Israel-supporting constituency happy. And that's not solely Jewish. There are a lot of WASPs and others who have traditionally been very supportive of Israel. But he also has to make the progressives in the party and the youth happy. And right now, Netanyahu is presenting him with a scenario where it's very difficult or impossible to do both at the same time. And that's why I think Sullivan and others have been trying to signal to Netanyahu to stop talking about these things in public.
Never enough time. Global affairs analyst and University of Michigan professor Juan Cole, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Steve.
So what's the bottom line? Israeli society has veered to the right, and even though there are many Israelis who lament their current situation, for now the rejectionists are in power. And there doesn't seem to be a chance for a lasting resolution. At the same time, the Palestinian leadership doesn't inspire much hope either, as Mahmoud Abbas remains in power and continues to delay or cancel fair elections. This month, he began his 18th year as president in a term that should have ended in 2009. But history doesn't move in a straight line. The extremism and, dare I say, racism that has now become part of the prevailing leadership of Israel may in fact finally trigger a political alternative that is long overdue in Israel, and a smarter, less corrupt generation on both sides that says enough is enough. Until then, any U.S. president will probably wait it out. And that's, sadly, the bottom line.